Serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 94-year-old Lila Morrison of Windsor, Colorado, originally from Blue Ridge, Georgia. A nurse on the front lines in Europe more than 70 years ago, she has since visited the National World War II Memorial through the Honor Flight Network. And come the end of May, she will be the Grand Marshal of the Boulder Boulder, the nation's largest Memorial Day celebration, with more than 70,000 people turning out annually at Folsom Field at the University of Colorado. She's going to take us back now to her time in Europe with the 118th Evacuation Hospital.
And this was a job, but I think it's clear to everybody listening that you poured your heart into this job and that you cared about each one of these individual patients. Is there one story, maybe it's hard to pick one from all the time you spent there, but is there one situation, one patient you treated that you look back on and you say, you know, that guy really kind of exemplified the courage of the American soldier in World War II?
Well, I can remember two. They were very different. One was a GI. You know, I mean, he was not an officer, non-com. When he came in, he was apparently had lost enough blood that he didn't know where he was. And he was talking to his buddy over here. Apparently they were in a foxhole. And he said, "Hey, Joe, did they get you to, or where are you hurt?" And he was hallucinating and whatnot, talking to his buddy.
Who wasn't there?
No. Then another man was, he was a little older, probably in his 30s. And at that time, that seemed old.
Yeah.
He was an officer. I remember he was hit in the throat, and he was very bad. He was conscious, though. And we were all working on him, and he looked at that, and, you know, he mouthed, you know, "Let me die. Let me die."
He wanted you to let him die.
Mm-hmm. Because he was so hurt. And talk about remembering how they turned out. See, I never knew of either one of them.
I mean, that's a situation that probably tears you in both directions, right?
It still does.
Still how do you know what the right thing to do there is?
Well, of course, we had doctors helping us, and we just did all we could to get them in as good a shape as possible. Lots of times you'd be hurt, and I'm sure it seemed terrible to each one, no matter where he was hit.
Yeah.
But this man hit in the throat, he really seemed upset, and he'd mouth that to us. But we didn't. We did all we could for him and sent him to surgery, so I don't know what happened after that.
And you told us about, you know, when you're training here in the States, you've got this tall, handsome gentleman who meets you and dances with you and says he wants to marry you, and you laugh it off. All those patients you treated, did you ever have any of them make similar proposals?
Oh, yes.
You say that like it happened every day.
No, we didn't have time for that every day. But, yes, that sounds a little braggadocious. But, you know, when you're over there and you've been over there several years, anything looks good to you. And they were so thrilled that we could talk English.
Uh-huh.
Oh, they'd mention that. Oh, you could speak English. That was good.
So how did you respond to those guys who approached you that way?
Oh, we're at war now. We really can't make future plans that far ahead. So I'm sure they had a girlfriend at home anyway.
Were there some things that you found in these situations where these guys are in dire straits? I mean, severe injuries. You don't know if they're going to make it. You don't know if they did make it. Were there some things that you found you could do to add a little comfort in those moments?
Mm-hmm. If we were real busy, we just couldn't take any extra time. We had to be working every second. But sometimes it'd be a little lull, and they'd always have pictures and always tell you where they're from, about the folks at home. Like I say, we were like mothers or sisters or somebody close to them. We enjoyed hearing about it. I did.
And here you spend a year seeing all these kinds of things. You survived the worst winter they've ever had with death all around you. But I imagine even all of that, even the worst of those days, couldn't have been as horrifying as what you saw when you got to the Buchenwald concentration camp.
That was terrible. That was bad. I still have a hard time believing it. And I saw it with my own eyes.
Did they prepare you for that? Did you have any idea what you were walking into there?
Not really. We didn't have time for that. I'd heard about them, of course, before I ever left the States. But there's a lot of difference in hearing about it and seeing it with your own eyes. That was hard. I still dream about that a little, because that was the largest concentration camp in Germany. And we arrived there, like I told you, that night. They told us, well, you girls have to go down in the morning to help with some of the prisoners. So the next morning we were ready to go, and they came up and said, you girls can't go. You're not going today. Our doctors are already down there, and conditions are so deplorable. We can't let you go down. So we didn't go that first day, but we did the next day. And they had it cleaned up pretty good from what it was. That was where they pyramided the bodies, and they had trenches dug, and they just pushed the bodies over into the trench. This is where they experimented with many of the prisoners. You know, you've read about the doctors.
My grandfather was doctor through the gates at 3:15 p.m. That's why the clock on the gate still says 3:15. Yeah. And the German doctor bragged to him about what they had done. And you've seen and read and the human lampshades and all the horrendous things. But what did you see when you got there that jarred your senses and your understanding?
Well, in the first place, the prisoners looked like they were worse than skin and bones. You wondered how they could even walk. And they all had the striped uniform on, you know. A lot of them had left, and the only means they had was walking. And we called them DPs. They were displaced persons.
Right.
But people from Czechoslovakia or wherever, they were walking home. And it was hundreds of miles. I don't know how they ate. Some of them even had babies. You wondered how in the world they could have kept them alive. But this man that took us through had been a prisoner there for quite a while. He had a jewelry store in Prague.
Mm.
And the Germans came in there one day and said, you know, come on, you're our prisoner. And so they brought him up to the camp. And he was married and had two children and owned a jewelry store. But he didn't know where his wife was or where his children were. He didn't know. But he took us all through the camp, took us up to the crematory, was kind of on a little hill, took us all through there and told us what happened to the prisoners. They had to slide down into the basement and take all their clothes off because they told them they were going to take a shower. So then they'd hit them on the head with, it looked like it's a big stick, and it looked like a pine knot. As they slid down, he told us they hit them in the back of the head, and they were knocked out, thankfully. Then we went upstairs to where the crematory was, and it was like a two-story thing, brick, and you stepped down into it, and they had eight ovens there, eight here. They had a wall there, big, long wall, and it had bottles with ashes. Now, I don't know why they saved those, but that's what they told us were there. That was a tough one. I still think of that and dream of it. Yeah, that was the worst. You couldn't understand how in the world you could treat another person that way. But we had one real good thing. It had a big iron gate and barbed wire really twisted around. It had a sign in English across, and it said 6.5 million Jews and political prisoners have been annihilated. And this man had apparently been a prisoner there for quite a while. And he ran up to us and he said, oh, you're Americans? And we said, yes. And he said, oh, I've been here. But when the Americans came, they had those big tanks. Oh, he was smiling. He was so happy. And I'd just never forgotten him. How wonderful he was there when he was free. And oh, they loved America. All of us, no matter who we were heroes to them.
And I imagine as tough as all of that was to see, that probably was as powerful an indication as any of how important the work you'd been doing was.
Oh, it was. Just made your heart want to pop. You were so happy to see at least one man. But you couldn't help but think about those 6.5 million, too.
Absolutely.
For no reason. The only reason was because they were Jewish.
Yeah.
Wasn't right.
Well, you go from the horror of that to, hey, remember that guy who wanted to marry me back in Texas? And you find out he's nearby, over there in Europe.
That's right. was up there in northern France. We were chosen to go home to the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
The first troops, they said, you're experienced. You know what it's about.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll go to the States, have 30 days leave, have 30 days training, and then you'll be going to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
That was hard to take.
After everything you've been through, you're going to see more of this?
Didn't want to at all.
Yeah.
And we talked to each other, said, let's cut off this little knuckle right here. Let's cut that off so we can't go. But, of course, we wouldn't have. We just couldn't believe it. I'd promised this young man that I had a brother in Gary, Indiana, which is right next to Chicago, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, would you come over to Chicago? Because I came home first.
But you saw him in Europe, right?
Yes, I did.
Well, what was that like?
Well, it was nice.
Did he ask you to marry him again?
Yeah, and I said, oh, no, I'm not marrying anybody till the war's over.
Uh-huh.
And if we go to Japan, I didn't want to be married, worrying about a husband, you know. That's the first thing he mentioned. Would you meet me in Chicago? Well, I hadn't said yes yet. So my sister was with me, and we got off the train. We were both still in uniform, of course. And he rushed up and grabbed me and hugged me. And my sister told me that people getting off the train were looking at us, and they were all crying. And mm-hmm. she was, too.
Sounds like a movie, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And she was 3 years older than I was, and she kind of had to approve of my boyfriends.
Uh-huh.
And so we were walking down the street after we met, and she punched me from behind. He was in the middle. She punched me from behind, and I looked, and she said, I like him. So
that was your green light, huh?
Yeah, that was my green light, I guess. And then, of course, the war was still going on, you know.
Not for long, though.
No, not for long. While we were in Chicago, VJ happened.
Uh-huh.
And he said, oh, now you don't have any excuse. You don't have any excuse. So we were married in Gary, Indiana. And it only lasted 65 years.
Well, and I think there's something else you're leaving out there. So he asked you again.
Mm-hmm.
You finally say yes.
Yeah, after VJ Day.
And how many days later did you get married?
About two. Because we had to go to Crown Point, Indiana to get our license.
Uh-huh.
See, at that time, they took 2 days holiday because they hadn't celebrated VE Day. So everything was closed. Well, you had to go to the hospital. At that time, you had to have a Wasserman test before you get married.
Mm-hmm.
That's a blood test. They'd have to mail that through the U.S. mail, that results of that test. He graduated from the University of Nebraska, and he told him he worked in a bookstore, and they had a little post office, you know, they used to do that,
mm-hmm.
and that he had been sworn in, and he was really a mail carrier. I tell you, he talked him into it. They gave it to us. We took it to the hospital. They read it and said it's okay.
Uh-huh.
We went to Crown Point, got our license, married the next day.
Well, I'm glad that they were more easily persuaded than you were, or you would have been waiting a while.
Well, I just didn't think it would be easy because he didn't know where he was going. He was going in, he learned later, Honshu Island on D+2.
Yeah, so he probably wouldn't have survived that. And he had to survive the whole war in Europe, mm-hmm. and you had to survive the whole war in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Yet here you come back together, as you said, only 65 years of marriage before you lost Walt,
mm-hmm.
but 3 kids and 7 grandkids and 5 great-grandkids. I guess somebody had a plan for you, huh?
Have I been blessed? I'm thankful every day. Every day I am.
What would you say you're most thankful for?
The good life. I've had a good life. I really have. I feel blessings every day.
When you went to that World War II memorial and you look at that wall of gold stars,
mm-hmm.
406,000 Americans who didn't come home, and you know maybe multiple stars could be represented by the guys in your hospital.
Yes.
What'd you think about there?
I thought it was great for them, but I also thought that there's a lot more names that could be there. It's a wonderful memorial, and I know the fellas would all be proud of it.
You're 95, mm-hmm. almost. Most of the people who served in World War II aren't here anymore.
That's right.
And in a few years, none of you will be here anymore.
That's right.
So what do the rest of us need to know? What do we need to understand about you and all those other Americans who helped win this war, defeat that regime that produced the concentration camp you witnessed, mm-hmm. and really held the world hostage mm-hmm. for all those years?
That's right. One thing that's uppermost, and I think of it so often, the freedom, the wonderful freedom that we have. We tend to take it for granted, and I probably would too if had I not had this experience. But I've seen, like at ball games and different places, when they play the national anthem, you'd see the kids playing over here. I mean, high school kids, and that hurt. Mm. Or to see somebody burn our flag, that hurts. It really does. Because, mm-hmm. Oh, the price was high. It was high. And I think of each one of those boys. They love to live, and they love their families, and they liked a nice home, and they liked to have enough to eat, just like you and I do, to experience life with all of its goodness and some badness. We all have that. And they didn't get to experience it anymore. Just cut off so short. But like I say, I never heard any of them complain or say, why me? They all were willing. And stand a little straighter when they play the national anthem. I just stand stiff and tall. I can't straighten up anymore, but I try. And oh, how thankful we are.
Well, I don't think anybody can say it better than you. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us about that price of freedom that you witnessed firsthand. And I guess the last thing for you, maybe this is a tough one to answer, but what would you say that you are most proud of?
Well, I'm proud that I could serve, very proud, and thankful. And I feel it's a privilege. Like you say, there's few of us left. These stories are going to be gone forever. If I can just impress a very few people, I'll be thankful.
There is no doubt in my mind you left a powerful impression on so many of us listening to your story today. That is Lila Morrison, 94 years old, of Windsor, Colorado. If you were moved today, grab that free podcast at hometownheroesradio.com and share it with your friends. There's even a little extra material there with Lila and with Brad Hoops, who recorded her story for his extensive oral history effort in northern Colorado. We are out of our radio time for today. I'm Paul Leffler, echoing that point that Lila's story drove home so strongly and vividly. Freedom is not free.